Good morning. This is Mike Robertson with you with John Langston, one of my partners here at Robertson Wealth Management. And we've got a very special guest on this morning. John and I were just talking during the break. The market is essentially flat. In fact, John was watching it. It was up. Futures are down one, then up two, then up 0.7. A lot of that has to do with what's going on in Europe. And we'll be talking with our guest this morning. If you'd like to call in and chat with us or with our guest, the phone number is 713-785-1817. That's 713-785-1817. Or if you're long distance, listen over there in Beaumont or Galveston, it's 877-881-0271. That's 877-881-0271. And, John, if you'd be so kind, would you introduce our guest, please?
I'd be glad to. Cullen Roche is an economist that started a site called Pragmatic Capitalism, which I would certainly recommend that you take a look at and follow on a daily basis. The actual URL is pragcap.com, P-R-A-G-C-A-P.com. Cullen is my favorite mythbuster. If you ever watch that TV show, Mythbusters, he is an economic mythbuster. And on his site, he has a piece he wrote. It's a little bit intellectually challenging. It's called Understanding the Modern Monetary System. Because we hear all the time people talking about we need to go back to the gold standard and whether or not we actually can and all that stuff. It gets a little mind-boggling. If you want to read that, it's well worth the time. Cullen is the founder of an investment partnership. He's a longtime writer on Seeking Alpha, for those of you who read on Seeking Alpha. He was listed by Business Insider as one of the 101 best financial people in the world. He's regularly cited in the Wall Street Journal, CNBC, and the Financial Times. At one time in his earlier years, he worked at Merrill Lynch Global Wealth Management, managing money. He's a Georgetown alumnus, grew up in D.C., now lives in Southern California where the weather is so bad. So I'd like to introduce you to Cullen Roche. I know some of you follow him, and please don't hesitate to call in and take any time to talk to him. Good morning.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good.
Fine, thanks.
Good to hear from you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Cullen, what do you think's going on? You know, you look at the Wall Street Journal this morning, first thing you see is headlines, Europe dims German outlook, Moody's is lowering its view for really the strongest economy in Europe, and that doesn't seem good if the prettiest girl in the dance has been downgraded from a 10 to a 7.
More like a 4 or a 5, maybe.
Oh!
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is just a real mess. I mean, it might be helpful for our listeners just to kind of go over some of the, basically the background of what they really designed over there, because it's really just an institutional design flaw that is really leading to a lot of confusion about what is really causing all of the crisis over there. Because what you have is sort of this, a mixture of a debt crisis and a balance of payments crisis and all of these things. And, you know, what we're seeing is sort of a similar, it's eerily similar to what happened in 2008 when everyone said that what we had in the USA was a banking crisis. And I kept saying at the time, I said, no, this isn't a banking crisis. It's a household debt crisis. And if you don't get to the root cause of the disease, we'll never fix it. So what's going on in Europe right now is interesting because you have everyone saying, oh, this is a balance of payments crisis and it's a debt crisis. And if we can fix those things, or the latest one now is everyone saying, oh, it's a growth crisis. And everyone's saying, oh, if we can fix the growth crisis, then we can fix Europe. But really what it is it's an institutional design flaw. The whole currency system is flawed. So what you really have over there is essentially a United States sort of institutional design with crucial missing pieces. So all of the nations in Europe are exactly analogous to the states in the USA. So none of them actually create the currency they use. But what you also have is you have, because they're all using the same currency, you don't have any floating exchange rates. So what happens over time, essentially, is you have an inherent imbalance in trade. So the periphery countries, the countries that don't produce a lot, they end up having to essentially take on more. They have to borrow from countries like Germany, who are the big producers. So it's kind of a double-edged sword, because what's going on is not only can they not fix the trade imbalance through floating exchange rates, but they don't have essentially what is the central treasury. So the USA, our states don't have solvency crises because we receive a huge amount of money from the federal government. because the government is essentially the issuer of the currency. Europe has an institutional design flaw where they've created a solvency crisis at the state level, at the national level for them, because they have a foreign central bank, essentially, and no central treasury, because they have no political unity. So the thing that I keep saying is the only way to fix this is to create what is essentially monetary sovereignty. You have to bring all of these nations back to having either their own currencies, or you have to create a full United States of Europe. And until they do that, we're just going to continue to see sort of this roiling, continual crisis in the area. So it's kind of it's frightening that they can't figure this out, really. So,
it really is. And like you say, they really don't have a central bank. They don't have a Ben Bernanke quite like we do. So anyway, we want to talk more about this. If you'll hang on, Cullen, we'll be back to you in just a few moments, folks. We've got Cullen Roach. We'll be talking about Europe. Hang on just a moment. Back to you in just a minute. Welcome back, folks. We're talking about Europe today. Not a surprise, not something that is really unusual to talk about. It seems like it resurrects itself every 2 or 3 weeks, and then there's a lot of excitement, a lot of things going on, but really significant this morning because Moody's has come out and indicated that they wanted to downgrade Germany, which is really the linchpin in Europe. They're the strongest economy of the Eurozone, and so we're fortunate enough this morning to have Cullen Roach with us. Cullen is an economist and hedge fund manager and one of the most respected people on the street and probably one of the most read people I know of on the Internet. And so, Cullen, we appreciate you being on, and you're right. You know, there's really no central banking system like we have here. And, it must have looked good on paper when they designed the Eurozone. But, you know, when they did that years ago, even I was amazed because I sat there because I had traveled in Europe and actually had lived in England for a short period of time. And I thought to myself, you know, nobody likes anybody over there. I mean, you have hundreds of years of wars over there. You've got 17 different languages. You've got 17 cultures. You've got 17 histories. And can this thing last? We had an economist, Dr. Nayantara Hensel, who was the former chief economist for the Department of the Navy, and she mentioned that she didn't think the euro was going to make it. What about you? Do you think it's going to make it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it kind of has to make it. I mean, the way that I kind of view this, you know, looking at, you know, trends over, you know, 100 or let's go with a 500-year you know, trend, what direction are we moving in? I mean, the global economy is getting so much smaller with every year. I mean, just through the Internet and the way that we're all becoming more interconnected. And I think that the, you know, part of what's going on has sort of just been forced on Europe. They're so close, they do so much business with each other that I think that over time, they've really had no choice but to become friends to some degree. And I think that trend is only going to, or that those ties are only going to grow stronger over time. So, to me, I think that what they need to do, I know this is, it's easier said than done, but I think that they need to sit down and just kind of come to this realization that, hey, the world's not becoming a bigger place. It's becoming a smaller place now. And we're only going to become more unified and more interdependent on each other as time goes on. So it makes sense to come to some sort of unified agreement. But like you said, I mean, the difficulty is, you know, we have hundreds of years of, you know, wars and strife that have gone on. And so, you know, they're kind of being forced, I think, now through the crisis to really, you know, hit the fast forward button on all of this. And, you know, I think Germany in particular is being forced to, you know, make some concessions that, you know, they're really uncomfortable with. But I think there are concessions that Germany has to make because ultimately, what you're looking at now is, you know, it's a lot like Germany's customers are the ones that are unhealthy. And the German economy can't really be healthy unless its customers are healthy. So I think that through some sort of unification, they can create something that is somewhat analogous to the United States. And I actually think that, you know, if they were to actually be able to pull this off and really create, you know, some sort of unified sort of a United States of Europe over there, I think it could be a really powerful thing. I mean, people were really skeptical of what the United States was building, you know, 200 and some odd years ago when we did it, you know, and you had the Hamilton and Jefferson debates and all that stuff about, you know, whether we should have a central bank and whether we should be, you know, unified under one currency or whether states should have their own currency, stuff like that. And, I mean, I think it turned out pretty well. I don't know about you guys, but so ultimately, to me, I think that they have to kind of move in this direction of becoming more unified, not less.
I think you're right, and hopefully Germany will hang in there. I read the story this morning about somebody that was actually over in that area, and they had two German newspapers, and one of them said they were going to one, the headlines were that Germany was going to abandon Spain. The other one said the headline was going to abandon Greece, and I know that in the German court system right now, there's some litigation as to whether or not the ECB bailout is actually legal, makes any sense to the Germans participate. And it makes a lot of sense for the Germans to keep holding things up, but can they financially afford to do so? I mean, can Germany and France, who are really, it's kind of a two-legged stool right now, can they afford to hold this group up as we get through this? Because I look at our own situation here, and we've gone from billions of dollars in debt to trillions of dollars in debt, and it seems all around the world, massive amounts of debt is being created without any strategy on how all this is going to be resolved or paid down.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's one of the things, bringing this all back home. I know this is kind of a mundane and detailed conversation, but I think that, you know, one of the most destructive myths that's going on right now is this comparison between the United States and Europe, and you see it from politicians in particular these days. But the funny thing is that the United States has the institutional design in place that is the solution for Europe. So if you actually look at the way that the relationships work, I've come up with a name for this. It's called a contingent institutional approach, which is understanding the way that the institutions are all interconnected in the USA to create what is essentially a currency issuer. And it eliminates a solvency risk. So what the government essentially does, the Treasury essentially is a user of the U.S. dollar. But they have a relationship with the Federal Reserve and the biggest banks in the USA, which are called the primary dealers, in which they're always able to harness or procure funds. So there's no risk of the Treasury ever not being able to obtain money. So there's no solvency risk in the USA. When you hear politicians say that, you know, we might be running out of money or that we have a debt constraint, they're just wrong, because there's no way that the U.S. Treasury could ever run out of money. So what I always talk about is that we don't have a debt constraint in the USA. We have an inflation constraint. We have essentially what is, you know, really either, you know, some sort of exogenous inflation constraint, like an oil supply shock or something like that, or we just sort of will bring the inflation upon ourselves through collapsing production or, you know, essentially putting too much money out into the economy and creating, you know, too much money chasing too few goods sort of scenario. I think we're clearly not in that scenario right now, because the growth in the USA is anemic. I think that the problem is not that the U.S. government doesn't have enough money, meaning that the U.S. government has to procure more funds, but that the private sector, meaning the currency users, all of us, we're the ones that don't have enough money. And the politicians don't realize this. And if they did, I think that what they'd do is they'd pass, you know, either massive tax cuts or they'd spend more money into the economy and they'd help the private sector rather than falling for this myth that, oh, we're the next Greece, we're running out of money and we need more money so that we can then, you know, fix our balance sheet and, you know, fix our solvency constraint, which is a complete myth. So it's interesting because Europe has the exact opposite problem, but the U.S. politicians see what's going on in Europe and they keep saying, oh no, what if we become Greece? And the funny thing is we can't become Greece because we've got the Greek fix already in place. We put it in place essentially in 1913 when the Federal Reserve was created, and we created the ability to harness our own banking system as a funding conduit. So there's no solvency constraint in the USA. There's no such thing as the USA running out of money or not being able to fund the Treasury's account at the Federal Reserve. And it's probably the most pervasive myth that we see out of this whole thing. And it's interesting because now you see with the, you know, the fiscal cliff and, you know, the potential for all these tax increases at the end of the year. I mean, this could really wreck the economy in 2013. And it's all because we think that we're running out of money. It's all because the politicians think that we can't afford, you know, what we've built here. And what they don't understand is that we never have a solvency constraint here. There's no such thing as us running out of money in the USA. We always have an inflation constraint, and inflation is, I think, what's headline inflation? The last reading was 1.7 or something. I mean, it's very reminiscent of Japan, and they went through the same exact situation in the 90s and the 2000s where they kept saying, gosh, we're going to go bankrupt. We're going to run out of money. But Japan also has the same exact institutional design that the USA has because they learned it from us. So it's funny, they've basically driven their economy into this anemic, low-growth state through completely misunderstanding what they built over there. So it's really interesting how the whole thing is sort of, you know, impacting the way everyone thinks about this, because it's led to just really what is mass confusion about the way that the institutional design of these various systems works.
And now, you know, go ahead. I'm
sorry. Go ahead. I know that's probably a lot to swallow.
Well, no. But because you hit on something very interesting, because you hit on Japan, and we seem to be following Japan into this slow growth cycle. And as you know, Japan has been close to zero interest rates for a couple of decades now. Are we looking at the same future in your mind? Do you think that we're going to have this low interest rate environment, slow growth to no growth environment for the years ahead?
Oh, gosh, I mean, I hope not. I've sort of been working under the theory over the last 4 or 5 years that we're Japan on fast forward, I keep saying. So I keep saying that we're not going to be in this 20-year malaise. I hope that's not just wishful thinking, because the more that this, you know, sort of crisis continues, the more it looks like that's going to be the situation. I think that we're a much more dynamic economy than Japan. I think that we have a lot of, you know, more positive trends in terms of demographics, in terms of just really the diversity of our economy, the size of it, its reach. So I think that we have the potential to really pull ourselves out of this thing if we want to. It's going to take time, because the problem in the USA is that it's not that the government took on too much debt, it's that the private sector took on too much debt during the housing bubble, and that's what's really suffocated the economy over the last few years. So a part of this is just sort of a secular pay down of private sector debt. And,
right.
You know, so you have to let that process play out. But I think that, you know, a lot of the policies we've put into place, a lot of them have helped the private sector do that. Not to the degree that I would have liked to see, but I think that over the next few years, we're starting to see the debt markets come back. We're starting to see people borrowing, which is a really positive sign, because it means that people's balance sheets are starting to get to a point where they're feeling healthy enough to start borrowing again. And that's really the key sign that this deleveraging is slowing to some degree, that it's, you know, becoming a more sustainable trend. So, you know, I think that the risk into 2013-2014 is that the government will become convinced that we, you know, are running out of money or something, and that they'll then, you know, raise taxes and, you know, essentially hurt the private sector at a time when the private sector needs this government cash flow, in essence. The private sector needs to keep more of their money now in order to be able to help their balance sheets heal, and so they can continue to pay down this debt and improve their balance sheets to a point where then, you know, we create sort of a sustainable situation where then we can really, you know, start to grow and expand the economy in a typical fashion. So,
Cullen, what would be your suggestion to Congress as to
right now
the fiscal cliff?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing that I would do if I had contact with any of these people, I'd teach them how their own monetary system works. I'd teach them how, and it's not a very complex thing. I mean, if you look at the way that the Treasury has a relationship with the Federal Reserve, and if you understand, you know, basically how a bank works, a bank is essentially an issuer of money. There's no such thing as the USA, you know, being able to run out of money. But for some reason, we all have this, I think it's because we compare, you know, the government to our own situation as being solvency constrained. This myth just persists. I mean, it continues to, you see it every single day. I heard, you know, Mitt Romney talking about it last night on CNBC about how we have a, you know, potential debt crisis in our future. And it's just, it's completely wrong, and it leads to very misguided policy across the board, because it's never the solvency that's the issue, it's the inflation that's the problem. And we could, you know, I know that some people will say that, oh, well, inflation is essentially a form of solvency, and that's true. Hyperinflation could wreck an economy, but we're so far from a hyperinflation situation right now that it's not even funny. We're essentially in the exact opposite. So I think that if the politicians understood this, I think that what they would do at the end of this year is they wouldn't even consider, you know, letting any of these tax cuts expire. They wouldn't even consider, you know, cutting the spending right now, because if they understood this whole situation, what they'd be saying is essentially asking themselves, okay, does the government need to take more money so that it can then use it, or does the private sector need more money right now? And if they ask themselves that question, knowing that there's no solvency constraint in this particular environment, I think it's a no-brainer. It's that the private sector needs to keep more of what they have. They need to keep more of the money that they have so that then they can, you know, go out and, you know, go to Walmart or go to, you know, Home Depot or, you know, buy food and gasoline and all the things that are, you know, necessities in life that essentially people are having trouble doing because they literally don't have the incomes or the, you know, or the healthy balance sheets to be able to do. So to me, it's kind of, it looks like everyone is just sort of, you know, playing politics at this point, and everyone's, you know, trying to get reelected and doing the usual thing, and they're saying whatever they think the people want to hear. And unfortunately, in the USA, a lot of the population thinks that we're running out of money, and I think that the politicians are feeding them that line because it's something that'll help them keep their jobs. So,
Cullen, if you'll hang on just a second, when we come back, we've got one other question to ask you. Where do you think the markets are going, and what keeps you awake at night? What is your biggest worry? So we're going to be back with Cullen Roach in just a few moments. Folks, stay with us. You're listening to Straight Talk Money, where you get straight answers to your questions about your money. Back to you in a minute. This lunch break is going to take all afternoon. Welcome back, folks. We've had Cullen Roach with us today. Great guest, great information. Thank you, Cullen, for being on. What I like to ask all my guests is, what keeps you up at night? What is the one thing that you really worry about that you think could be a game changer going forward here in the economy?
Well, I have a new puppy at home, so the thing that keeps me up at night is my dog right now. But no, I would say that the thing that is most worrisome to me is this fiscal cliff at the end of the year, this potential that we're going to have, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, maybe even trillions over the next few years of cuts at a time when we look very much like Japan did in the 90s. And the frightening thing, the scenario that frightens me the most, is that what could happen is if we were to make, you know, really substantial cuts in the budget deficit right now, that what could potentially happen is you hurt the private sector balance sheets to the point where we sort of enter this phase very similar to what you're seeing in either Spain or Greece, or, you know, really something like what the USA was entering into in 2008. The only reason we pulled ourselves out of it was because we passed, you know, that huge tax cut, that huge, you know, bailout of the entire system, in essence. And, you know, I think that if we were to put ourselves back into that situation, I mean, what you have in Spain and some of these countries that have implemented these really harsh austerity programs, thinking that, you know, oh, if they can cut spending, you know, and they can increase taxes, then they'll be able to somehow, you know, grow through austerity or something. I mean, you've got economies over there that have just been pulverized. I mean, stock markets that are down 75-90%. I mean, we're talking about just complete decimation, you know, youth unemployment in the 50% range. I mean, just a real disaster scenario across the board. And I don't think that that's going to happen in the USA, but I think that, you know, there's the risk that if we were to really, you know, full bore into, you know, believing that, you know, we are one of these countries that we have a solvency constraint like that, I think there's the potential that, you know, you create sort of this Japanese scenario where, you know, the economy just sort of is, you know, this roller coaster of crisis after crisis and, you know, anemic growth where people are constantly concerned about everything. So that's my big worry.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for being
on
today. Thanks, John, for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
And folks, as always, thank you so much for listening. We appreciate you sharing part of your day with us. I hope you have a great day. I hope you make a little money today. And I hope God bless you today. God bless, folks. Talk to you.
You've been listening to Straight Talk About Money with Mike Robertson. Listen every day at 8 a.m. If you want to contact Mike today, call 713-624-4004. That's 713-624-4004. Or log on to RobertsonWealthManagement.com. The opinions voiced in this program are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, financial advisor, or tax advisor prior to investing. Securities are offered in the United States through First Allied Securities Incorporated, a registered broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through First Allied Advisory Services Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
You know, we talk a lot about mutual funds on the show and occasionally discuss variable annuities. Mike wants you to remember that you should carefully consider the risk, charges, and expenses of a mutual fund or variable annuity prior to investing. This and other important information can be found in the fund's prospectus or variable annuity sub-account prospectus. Contact your advisor for a copy and always read it carefully before investing.